could not. Several important gentlemen, including the Prime Minister and the Queen's doctor, were plotting how to do away with her Indian servant. Talk of intrigue, foreign plots and treason. If someone had told me about it, I should not have believed them, thinking it a wild exaggeration. But I had heard with my own ears, and I could tell nobody. "Why should you worry?" I said to myself. "It does not concern you. You are certainly not fond of this Munshi. And if he is a foreign spy, he must be removed some way or another." But the talk of poisoning his food had unnerved me. After all, I was one of Her Majesty's cooks, one of those who handled the food. If anything happened to the Munshi, the suspicion would fall on my colleagues and on me. Chapter 21. In the light of morning, the scene I had overheard did not seem real. I almost wondered whether I had dreamed it. I breakfasted, enjoyed the taste of the still warm bread and the tart sweetness of the apricot jam, then went to work. I made a batch of little cakes, maids of honour, and brandy snaps for tea. All of these kept well in tins. I had just finished the brandy snaps, rolling them when still warm around a spoon handle, when Chef Lepin came up to me. "What are these?" he asked. I told him. "They are filled with cream before they are served." "May I try?" I held out the one I had just finished. He took a bite. "Ah, they have spices. Ginger, I think, and a touch of cinnamon?" "And brandy, of course," I replied. He savoured the one bite. "An interesting texture. Lacy. Crisp. Perhaps you could share this recipe. There are now guests at the hotel who expect the English tea time." "Dear me," I said. "An English recipe you consider worthy of cooking? Wonders will never cease." He looked at me and laughed. "I'll trade you my brandy snaps for your octopus." He held out his hand to me. "D'accord," he said, meaning he agreed. I was unprepared for the jolt of electricity I felt when his hand touched mine. I must have stammered something about getting back to work. I could feel my cheeks flaming, and I suspected he was chuckling at my discomfort. "He is teasing you, Bella," I told myself. "He is using his French charm to make you uncomfortable. You mean nothing to him." But all the same, it was exhilarating to know that a man's touch could have this effect on me. I had begun to wonder whether I was strange or cold because I had not been thrilled by Nelson's kiss. Now I knew that I had just been waiting for the right man. I soon discovered that working at the hotel was very different from being in the palace kitchens. There we were, shut off from the life of the royal family. We had no idea who came and went, what small dramas unfolded. We cooked the meals, sent them off with footmen, and mostly had no idea whether they were well received or not, unless there was a complaint, which was rare. Here we were, in close proximity to those we served. Our narrow passageways passed behind their rooms, windows were open, and we overheard conversations, and we got glimpses of their lives. After what I had heard the night before, I overheard another strange conversation that morning. I had just come out of the servants' entrance for a breath of fresh air after putting various cakes and pastries into hot ovens. I walked around towards the front of the hotel, enjoying that breeze that came up from the seashore with a hint of salt to it. I was just rounding the turret at the end of the hotel when I heard a shrill voice saying, "But you must give it to me. I order you to." I glanced up and saw that windows were open on the floor above me. I thought at first that it was one of the royal children, but a male voice replied, "Your Highness, I am only thinking of your well-being. You know that your mother would not approve. She would be horrified if she found out." "You are not to tell her. I absolutely forbid you tell her," came the female voice, now even more shrill and with a note of panic to it. "Then I urge you to be sensible and to stop this nonsense while you still can."
"But I don't want to stop. It is my one pleasure in life."
"That is your choice, but I will do nothing to aid it. Good day to you, Your Highness." This conversation left me as shocked and intrigued as the last one. One of Queen Victoria's daughters, unless it was one of her grandchildren and the voice had sounded too mature to be the 10-year-old girl, what did she want? And was that Dr. Reed who was refusing her? Life was definitely more interesting in Nice, I decided. I was about to turn around and go back to keep an eye on my baking when I heard the strangest noise. It was part cry for help, part someone choking. I could not for the life of me place it, so I had to run around the building to see for myself. What was standing outside the Queen's entrance at the front of the hotel was a tiny cart pulled by a white donkey, which was now braying and making those extraordinary sounds. A peasant selling vegetables? I thought. But I was sure that such a vehicle would not be allowed to stand in the forecourt beside the smart carriages. Then I realised. How sweet, I thought, it must be for the Queen's grandchildren. Guess what I have just seen, I reported on coming back into the kitchen. There is a cart being pulled by a donkey outside the hotel.
Oh, that donkey cart, I heard about that, Mr. Angelo said, giving Mr. Phelps a knowing grin. Rumour has it that the Queen came upon a peasant ill-treating his donkey. She was so shocked and upset that she paid for the beast on the spot, and now she keeps it stabled here so that she can ride around the area in a little cart. He grinned as he turned back to me. It's outside now, is it? Let's go and have a look.
I'd like to see for myself.
The other cooks decided they would like a peek too, so we piled out of the back door and hurried around to the front of the hotel. As we came around, we heard an imperious voice saying,
No, not like that, you fool. Hold the beast's head while I assist Her Majesty.
It was the Queen's Munchie, and Queen Victoria clung onto his arm while she came forward using her stick. Two of her grandchildren followed her, their mother keeping a watchful eye on them.
Surely there is not room for you all, Princess Beatrice called as the Queen was helped into the seat. And is that poor little donkey strong enough to pull you all in the cart?
Nonsense. They are tiny scraps. They don't take up any space at all, the Queen said. Come on, children, let's go for a ride, shall we?
The two children climbed in eagerly, squeezing in beside their grandmother, and they set off. A groom walked at the donkey's head and the Munchie at the Queen's side. Mr. Angelo turned to us with an amused grin.
What some people will do for entertainment.
Still, I suppose if you are Empress of half the world, it makes a change to live like a peasant for a moment.
He headed back to the kitchen, and I was about to fall in behind him when a voice said,
You girl!
I turned around to see Princess Helena beckoning to me. I went up to her and curtsied.
You wanted something, Your Royal Highness?
Yes, I want you to run a small errand for me. You are to take this paper and find a chemist's shop in the town. Hand the paper to the pharmacist, pay him and bring what he gives you directly to me. Do you understand?
She thrust a sheet of paper at me. I felt myself blushing bright red with confusion.
But, Your Highness, I can't go into town. I have work to do here.
Nonsense. I am sure your work here can wait. I need these items immediately.
But, Your Highness, I am one of the cooks. I have to prepare my part of the luncheon, and I have cakes that need to come out of the oven directly.
She was looking at me as if I was some strange kind of insect she had never seen before.
You are one of my mother's cooks, you say?
Yes, ma'am, I nodded, then I added boldly. I am currently the pastry chef.
A female chef? How quaint.
How novel, she sighed.
Well, in that case, I suppose I cannot tear you away from your endeavours.
My mother would not be at all pleased if luncheon were not served on time.
I curtsied again for good measure.
I'm very sorry, Your Highness. Cannot your maid fulfil this errand for you? Or a hotel servant?
My maid, I fear, reports back to my mother. But you are right.
There must be a hotel messenger boy who can carry out this commission. I'll go and see. And she strode off across the forecourt. I watched her go, realization dawning. It had been her voice I had heard coming from that window arguing with the doctor.
Now I understood. I had caught a glimpse of what was written on that sheet of paper when she had tried to thrust it at me. 2 bottles, Bayer heroin, 1 bottle, laudanum, 1 packet, needles. I had no experience or real knowledge about these things, but I had heard rumours, and my mother, before she died, had taken to using laudanum to the point that my father had become concerned for her. So now I understood the desperation in her voice. The needles were not for sewing. They were for injecting substances into her body. Princess Helena was addicted to drugs. Another fact I knew but could tell nobody. I was hurrying in before my cakes burned when I overheard my name, at least my adopted name. "Barton," said a man's voice. "No, I don't recall anyone of that name in Her Majesty's employ." He repeated this in French, but with a strong English accent. I turned around to see one of Her Majesty's gentlemen talking to what looked like a messenger boy. I took a deep breath and went over to them. "I am Helen Barton," I said. "I am one of Her Majesty's cooks."
"You are a cook for Her Majesty?"
"Remarkable," the gentleman said. I saw that the messenger was holding a letter. "Is that a letter for me?" I asked in French. The messenger boy nodded and handed it to me.
"From the Viscount Faversham."
I took it, my cheeks burning. "I'm afraid I have no money on me," I stammered.
"My master has paid me well. Do not concern yourself," he said,
gave a little bow, and then took off. The gentleman was staring at me in a way that made me most uncomfortable.
"Since when do servant girls receive letters from viscounts?" he asked.
"We met at Lady Crozier's party," I replied. Oh, how I would love to have told him that Giles Waverley was my cousin. "I was invited to be part of the tableau." The gentleman shook his head.
"This is not a wise thing, young woman. Liaison outside of your class can only end in tragedy, especially for the girl involved."
"Oh, no, sir," I said. "It is nothing like that. I quite understand Viscount Faversham promised to show me the beach by his villa. That is all. I have no intention of anything more."
"Make sure you stick to that," he said. "Young aristocrats tend to think that servant girls are easy pickings, if you get my meaning." "Sir Arthur, are you free?" a man called from the hotel steps. "A word, if you don't mind." "I hope you'll take my warning to heart, young lady." Sir Arthur gave me a little nod and left me standing there. I watched him go with interest, not because of what he had just told me, but because I recognised his voice. His was the high-pitched, clipped sound from the balcony that night, and he was Sir Arthur Bigg, the Queen's secretary. I waited until I was safely inside the building before I opened the letter. "Dear Miss Barton, I hope you won't think it impertinent writing to you, but I did so enjoy our little talk the other evening, and I would like to see you again. I know you told me you are at Her Majesty's beck and call, but my time is my own. Any moment you are free, I will come with the carriage to sweep you away for an hour or two. I would so like to show you the area around our villa. It is so beautiful. Yours sincerely, Giles Waverley." I shouldn't reply, I told myself. As Sir Arthur had said, no good could come of this. When Giles Waverley found out I was merely a cook, it would be an embarrassment for both of us. But the truth was that I had enjoyed his company. He seemed like a nice, harmless young Englishman, and what could be wrong with a ride in his carriage in broad daylight? Then a wicked thought came to me. If he tried in any way to get fresh, I would reveal that I was his cousin. Surely that should make him stop and consider. I had done so many things that were not wise or sensible lately, and they had all worked out well. Maybe this was another of my father's occasions to carpe diem. I resolved, if the occasion arose, that I would write back to Giles Waverley and accept his invitation. Our next royal encounter came that afternoon. We had finished the luncheon service and were just sorting out the items that had come back uneaten. Of these, there were usually plenty, as the Queen liked enough choice of items in each of the courses.
"I see they liked your fried fish, Mr. Williams," Mr. Angelo said.
Not a morsel returned. Too bad. I was hoping for a little of that myself. The fish looked rather tempting, Mr. Williams replied.
We looked up as the kitchen door opened, and in came Count Wilhelm, the betrothed of Princess Sophie. He swept in, stood looking around him.
You are the English chefs, yeah?
We are, Your Highness. Can we help you? Mr. Angelo asked as I dropped a curtsy.
I very much hope so, the Count said in his strongly accented English. He strode right up to Mr. Angelo. I am most disappointed in the food that you serve to my royal relatives.
In what way, sir? Mr. Angelo was not easily cowed and stepped forward to confront the Count.
Fleisch, the Count said. There is not enough fleisch.
You mean meat, sir? Lamb cutlets were served at luncheon and squab. The Count waved his hands dismissively.
This is food for old ladies and delicate women. I am a man. I must have my fleisch to keep up my strength. Where was the pork schnitzel? Where was the Rindfleisch? The famous English roast beef?
I'm sorry, sir, but this is France. You won't find English roast beef here.
Count Wilhelm frowned.
Are you being disrespectful? Are you mocking me?
Not at all, sir, but what I say is true. I'm afraid the hotel has not been able to find a joint of beef that meets my high standards yet, Mr. Angelo replied. You have to understand, we are at the mercy of what the French butchers can send us. In France, they do not eat big hunks of meat. It is expensive here, so it is not so easily obtained. But I have put out word that they are to have some shipped from England if necessary.
And in the meantime, I starve, the Count said.
I doubted this. For a young man, he was awfully round. His yellow satin waistcoat only just met across his belly.
You must make sure I have enough good meat at every meal, he said. If not the roast beef, then liver, kidneys, brains, fortifying food, food fit for a healthy man like myself.
Very good, my lord, Mr. Angelo said. I could tell he wasn't quite sure how to address a German count. Was he a royal or merely an aristocrat?
And another thing, the man wagged a finger in Mr. Angelo's face. Who is responsible for the Nachspeisen, the pudding, as you call it?
That would be Miss Barton, Mr. Angelo said. Wilhelm turned to me in surprise.
A woman? You let a woman make the dishes?
Miss Barton is an accomplished cook, Mr. Angelo said. I could have hugged him.
Very well.
He turned to face me.
Was something not to your liking, Your Highness? I asked.
These puddings, the creams and the ices and the delicate little pastries,
they are for the women.
And yesterday you served the Milbrei, such as we give to children in Germany. Where are the knödel, the dumplings, the English suet puddings, the things that really satisfy?
I'm so sorry, sir, I said. The Queen is not too fond of heavy puddings, and Milbrei is her favourite, especially after travelling. You surely understand that meals are planned to please her. At home, she must approve all menus. I'm sure she will hear, too, once she has settled in.
Then make hers a Milbrei, make hers a frothy creams, but for the love of God, make me a proper pudding.
I will do my best, Your Highness, I said, and gave him another curtsy, which he obviously approved of.
Excellent. Carry on, carry on,
he waved a hand in our direction. Then, on the way out, he stopped.
What are these?
Brandy snaps for today's tea, I said. He picked one up and popped it into his mouth.
Not bad, he said, his mouth still full. And this cake? Is the icing chocolate or coffee?
And to my horror, he ran his finger across the top of my cake and spooned up a big dollop of icing. He sucked on his finger.
Ah, chocolate. Gut.
He looked around once more and his gaze fell upon Jimmy.
And what do you cook, young man?
Jimmy is our apprentice, Mr. Angelo replied. He does all the basic preparations. He is still learning.
Very good. Carry on.
The Count nodded, then swept out. The door swung shut behind him.
Ruddy cheek, Mr. Angelo said. His face was bright red. Coming in here like Lord Muck, as if he owns the place.
And look at my cake, I said. I'll have to scrape off all this icing and make a new batch.
Miss Barton, I'm so sorry that you have been insulted in this way, Mr. Phelps said. I've never seen anything like it. Have you, Mr. Angelo? Never in all my years in the kitchen.
I have not, and I don't think Her Majesty would approve of such behaviour, Mr. Angelo said. She is always most courteous with her staff. I think I'll have a little word with Sir Arthur, her private secretary. We're not having that fat bloke coming in and out of our kitchen when he feels like it.
Can one of us be of any assistance, Miss Barton? Mr. Angelo said. Jimmy, get down the icing sugar and the chocolate powder for our pastry chef.
There was a joint effort to rescue my cake. I was still seething with annoyance, but at the same time, I felt a warmth inside. We were a team. We cared about each other. Chapter 22. As it happened, my chance to see Giles Waverley came sooner than I had expected. We were informed that the following day Her Majesty was to dine with her cousin, King Leopold of the Belgians, who had a villa just outside Nice. The members of her household would be content with a cold supper, and we could have the afternoon off.
I'm glad he's not coming here, dirty old man, Mr. Angelo muttered after he gave us the news. We'd have to keep our Miss Barton safely locked away in the kitchen. He gave us a knowing look. He has an inclination for young girls, so we understand. You may be a bit old for him, Miss Barton, but you still have that bloom of youth about you.
Didn't I hear that he has his mistress with him? Jimmy asked. I don't know how he managed to find out all these titbits of scandal. Mr. Angelo obviously thought the same thing.
Where do you find out all this rubbish, Jimmy? I hope you are not mixing with the wrong type of person.
Oh no, Mr. Angelo, I was chatting with some of the footmen. They were telling me stories like you wouldn't believe. They said he has a predilection for little girls.
Imagine, an old man like that. Disgusting, that's what it is.
Oh, and another thing. He paused, his smile broadening. They say he lets his fingernails grow ever so long, so it's impossible to shake hands with him without getting stabbed. Can you imagine it?
I'm surprised Her Majesty chooses to associate with him, even if he is her cousin, Mr. Williams said in a disapproving voice. You know how particular she is about correct behaviour and marital fidelity?
Well, I'm just glad Her Majesty is going there and we don't have to feed him, Mr. Phelps chimed in. I would like to put a big dose of cascara in his food.
Mr. Phelps, I'm shocked at you, Mr. Angelo said.
There was a pause, and then they both laughed.
He wouldn't be able to open the lav door in time with those long fingernails, he added.
We all joined in the laughter.
Do you think all the royal persons are creepy in some way? Jimmy asked. Do you think they behave badly just because they can?
I have to point out that Her Majesty is a perfect example of decorum, Mr. Williams said, giving Jimmy a hard stare. And her daughters too, I am sure.
I said nothing about Princess Helena, but Jimmy was not about to be silenced.
She had that John Brown fellow for a while, didn't she? And now that Indian bloke goes everywhere with her. That's not normal, is it?
There is nothing suspicious about their relationship, Mr. Angelo said. He is a wily snake who is playing upon her loneliness and desire for attention. And she likes young men around her, and she likes the exotic. Why else would she travel with Highland pipers when she could bring perfectly ordinary soldiers to guard her? But her relationship with them is only that of sovereign to subject, I am sure.
I'll tell you who else gives me the willies, Jimmy said.
That Count Willie. I agree, his behaviour is not acceptable, Mr. Angelo said. But I don't know why it should worry you.
I'm not talking about messing with the food, Jimmy said. He came out of the dining room after dinner last night and asked me to come up and see him in his room later.
Well, I wasn't born yesterday, Mr. Angelo. I got a whiff of what that might mean, so I said that I was sorry, but I had to report back to do the washing up.
You were quite right, my boy, Mr. Angelo said. We servants always have to keep our guard up. We never know where the next impropriety is coming from. And he looked at me, clearly remembering what I had told him about the Prince of Wales. I was still thinking about this when I went upstairs to my room to write a note to Giles Waverley. Sir Arthur Bigg had said that we were easy pickings. Was that how Giles Waverley saw me? What if the carriage stopped at his villa and I was invited inside? Would I go? How could I refuse? But if I turned down anything that might be dangerous, what a boring life I would lead. So I took up my pen and wrote that I would be free the following afternoon and would await his carriage at the entrance to the hotel grounds. I certainly didn't want anyone observing me getting into a carriage with a strange man. Then, of course, came the question of what to wear. I certainly could not sit in a carriage in my cotton blouse or my evening gown. I wondered if my new dress might be ready, or if Claudette's mother had found the fabric impossible to work with. How would I get a chance to find out? I resorted to a little subterfuge. If we are to serve a cold supper to the household, may I go to the market early tomorrow morning and buy fruit and vegetables to make salads? They are so much fresher there. Mr. Angelo raised an eyebrow. If I didn't know better, I'd think you'd met a boy at the market you were sweet on, he said. This made me blush, thinking of my encounter with Chef Lupin. But I said, Oh no, cook, absolutely not. But I have to confess, I do enjoy the atmosphere of the market, the flowers, all the bright colours, and I'll go without my breakfast, so I won't waste any of your time. All right then, he said. He reached into a pocket and produced a coin. You're a good girl and you work hard. Who am I to deny you a little pleasure? Buy yourself a sprig of flowers while you are there. Thank you, cook. I beamed at him. I rose extra early the next morning. To my annoyance, it was cold and a fine drizzle was falling. That might spoil my plans for a carriage ride. I presumed it would be an open carriage, as they mostly seem to be around here. But undaunted, I grabbed a cup of coffee, put on my cape, and off I went down to the town. I had learned by now not to count on the trolley, so I walked, encountering various tradespeople on their way to work. But even at that hour, when the sun would have been visible, had it not been for the heavy clouds that hung over the ring of hills around the city, the market was in full swing. I did my shopping first, selecting various vegetables and grapefruit, apples and oranges for a fruit salad. I was about to make my way to Claudette's mother when I saw Chef Lupin. He was standing at a stall that seemed to be laden with objects I didn't recognise, dirty brown earthy globes and what looked like bits of dung. I couldn't think what they were or what he might do with them. Curiosity got the better of me. "Excuse me, Chef," I said. He turned, and I was gratified to see that he looked pleased. "Allô, the young lady is up bright and early. My compliments. You are buying fish again?" "No, today it's items for salads. The Queen is out tonight and her household will have a cold supper." "Ah," he nodded. "May I ask what these things are?"
"Different types of mushrooms. You do not have mushrooms in your country?"
"We do, but just the round flat variety. Nothing like these." I pointed at some bright orange little bells that looked lethal to me.
"Are they all edible?"
"I would not be serving them to the guests if they weren't," he said. "These chanterelles, they have exquisite taste. These are straw mushrooms." He pointed to a cluster of thin white stalks. "These we call cep. These big ones are trumpet royale, and these morel. Although you must never pick these for yourself, the false morel look very similar and can be fatal. Try the chanterelle. You must cook some for your queen. She will approve."
"But that thing you were going to buy, how does one cook that?" "It looked like a dirty ball of earth." He rolled his eyes.
"That, cherie, is worth more per gram than gold. It is a truffle. You do not have truffles?"
"No."
"Then let me instruct you. The truffle is a fungus that grows on the roots of certain oak trees. Under the soil, you understand. They can only be located by specially trained dogs. Oh, and by pigs if they can get at them. They have a deliciously different flavor, We make the truffle oil for cooking, or we use a small amount to raise the quality of the dish. I will give you a taste tonight and you will see. Only a tiny taste, you understand. More expensive than gold, eh?
Thank you, I said. I have to take some of the orange ones. Chanterelles, did you call them? And try them at luncheon.
Chef Lupin handed a piece of truffle to the stallkeeper, who weighed it and mentioned a ridiculous price. He waited while I chose the more modest chanterelles.
So do you head back to the hotel now?
If you wait a while, we will walk together.
I have another commission in the town, I said. I'll see you back at the hotel.
I understand, he said.
No, you don't, I wanted to say. I really do have another commission. I could tell he had taken it as a brush off. Oh, why did men have to be so complicated?
Mademoiselle, he said as an afterthought, it is well that you buy your mushrooms here, from this stall. Here I know they are picked with care and are safe. Other mushroom sellers are not so careful, and one bad mushroom can kill you very quickly.
Thank you for the advice, chef, I said. I will watch how you cook tonight.
Very well.
He nodded, gave me a little bow, and walked in the opposite direction. I made my way to the house that clung to the edge of the castle hill. I knew it was still rather early to make a call, but Claudette's mother came out of her front door just as I was approaching, paused and smiled when she saw me.
Oh, it is the young English lady. I was wondering when you would return for your dress.
Is it finished? I asked.
I may have to make some minor adjustments, she said, but I don't think so. I've been doing this for long enough that my measurements are usually correct.
Unless you have been eating too much for the past few days?
Oh no, madame, I laughed. Then come inside.
She held open the door for me. Were you not on your way somewhere? I asked. I don't want to hinder you.
It can wait. Just to buy bread. Come.
She ushered me into the little dark room.
There, she said. What do you think?
On a dressmaker's dummy was a dress, a really pretty dress.
That is not mine, I said wistfully. It is. Try it on.
But no, my fabric was plain blue-green.
Your fabric was not strong enough for a whole dress, she said.
See, I have used it in the skirt panels and the sleeves. I picked up the skirt. The other fabric had a sheen to it and was sprigged with a flower design in a royal blue and gold. But the rest of the fabric,
it is lovely. It is. It was a marquise who brought it to me.
She has good taste.
I can't use another woman's fabric, I stammered.
She grinned, revealing that mouth with many missing teeth.
These are rich people. They bring me meters and meters of fabric. There is always much left.
They don't care. I say to them, what do you wish that I do with the remaining fabric? And they say,
whatever you like. I am happy with my dress. I don't need the rest.
While she spoke, she was removing the dress from the dummy. And she helped me off with my blouse and skirt and slipped the dress over my head. It fitted perfectly. So slim in the waist, it did look as if I was wearing a corset. The neckline was prim and demure, as befitted someone in my position. I turned around, examining myself in the speckled old mirror.
It's wonderful, I said.
She was grinning as if she had performed a magic trick for me.
It is worth the effort to make a dress for a pretty young girl like you. And you will tell your friends that Francine Dubois makes good clothes, no?
I will, I said, regretting that I didn't have any friends to tell. Once I took it off, she packed up the dress in tissue paper, and I paid her what seemed quite a modest sum. A quick calculation made me realize that I should spend some of my wages on more clothes while I had such a talented dressmaker at my disposal.
I would like you to make more clothes for me, I said.
What do you suggest, and where should I buy the fabric so that it is of better quality?
I know nothing. She patted my hand. Let me see what I can do. Come back in about a week and I should have something for you to try on.
I couldn't thank her enough, and I think I floated all the way back up the hill. By midday, the clouds had rolled away and the sun was peeking through. Mr. Angelo was apparently familiar with chanterelles and had prepared them on previous occasions on the continent. He cooked them in butter to be served as a side dish at luncheon and heard back from the Queen that she was so delighted he had found the little orange mushrooms again.
"You've got a good eye, my girl," he said.
"And Chef Le Pan is going to show me how to use truffles tonight," I said.
"That French Johnny seems to be getting rather familiar with you," he said. "I'd watch out if I were you."
"Cook, he's just pleased that I take an interest in his cooking."
"Oh, is that what he tells you?"
He paused, then added,
"He's a handsome man. He's foreign, and you've been sheltered all your life. Just keep it to the cooking, all right?"
"Of course," I said. My world seemed to be full of men with good intentions about my virtue. Chapter 23. As soon as luncheon was over, I rushed up to my room, washed myself carefully to get rid of possible cooking smells, splashed on a little rose water, and put on my new dress. Thank heavens Madame Dubois had made it to fasten at the front. She must have guessed I had no maid to do up hooks at the back. I brushed my hair and carefully pinned it up. I was going to take my shawl, but I decided that it looked old and worn, and I'd rather freeze if necessary. I came down the stairs, crept around the other side of the building where ordinary guests were housed, or rather, non-royal guests, as the prices here were too steep for ordinary people, then made my way successfully through the gardens and out to the front gate. I hadn't been waiting long before a smart carriage came up the hill towards me. It was open, as were most of the vehicles I had seen here, a light gig pulled by a handsome bay horse. Giles was holding the reins himself, and his red blonde hair was blowing out in the breeze. He actually looked rather dashing. He pulled the horse to a halt beside me and jumped down.
"Well, this is a treat," he said. "Hello, Bella. It was so good of you to agree to come out for a spin with me. Don't you look terribly nice?"
And he helped me up onto the padded leather seat.
"It turned out to be a lovely day for a spin. I was quite depressed this morning when I saw the weather, but it has cleared up beautifully."
He was doing what we English do when we're a little awkward and tongue-tied. We talk of the weather. "It promises to be a lovely afternoon," I agreed.
"Yes, it does," he said with enthusiasm, and I realized he wasn't talking about the weather.
We made our way slowly down the steepest part of the hill, then skirted around the back of the old town, coming out to the little port where fishing boats bobbed at moorings and fishermen sat mending nets. On the other side, the road started to climb again, this time hugging a cliff beside the sea. Below us was a spectacular drop to blue water, and to our left, the hillside rose steeply, now dotted with occasional villas and gardens. We came around a corner and I gasped. Giles grinned as if he had put on this view especially for me. Below us was a narrow bay. This time, the boats at mooring were large pleasure yachts. Green hills dropped sharply on all sides, dotted here and there with occasional pastel villas, surrounded by lines of dark cypress trees or tall palms. A little town clung to the hillside with a busy port below us. We had exchanged a few pleasantries along the way. How I was enjoying Nice so far, whether I had attended any other parties, what I thought of French food. Mostly Giles had pointed out places of interest. He did so now.
"That's the town of Villefranche-sur-Mer," Giles said. "It's a free port. It helped the French king once against pirates or Italians or something, and now they don't have to pay any taxes."
"How convenient," I said, making him laugh.
"I must say the idea appeals to my father, and to me too. The death duties on our estate are going to be crippling when he goes. I only hope that I can afford to keep it on." He gave a little shrug. "Like most men in my position, I'm not much use for anything else."
I thought of my father being sent out to the army in India, a profession to which he was completely unsuited, and then being at the beck and call of guests at the Savoy. He must have suffered, knowing that, had birth order been different, he would have been living a life of leisure, just the way I had suffered on finding myself as a servant to a nouveau riche family. How I would have liked to tell Giles the truth. How interested he would have been to know, but I couldn't risk it. He'd only have to let slip one word at the wrong time to the wrong person, and it would get back to the Excelsior Regina, and I would be dismissed. Instead, I chatted on pleasantly as we skirted the side of the bay. "That road takes us out to Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat," he said. "Lots of lovely villas out there, lots of money, Rothschilds and the like. And that old devil King Leopold has bought up all the property he could get his hands on. I suppose you've met him."
"I haven't," I said, "but the Queen is dining with him this evening."
"They say he's quite repulsive," Giles said, "and with depraved habits. So it's lucky you've managed to avoid him so far. But I presume you've met the Prince of Wales?"
"Oh, yes," I said with more emphasis than I meant. "I have met the Prince of Wales."
"I feel sorry for the chap myself," Giles went on. "I mean, stuck waiting for his mother to die, having no real role in life. But actually, I suppose I identify with him. I have no real role either. My father won't let me take over any of the running of the estate. He thinks I'm going to drag it to ruin when he dies. I'm afraid he doesn't think too much of me. I'm somewhat of a disappointment."
"Why?" I asked.
"Oh, I don't know. I prefer art to hunting, and I hated boarding school, not being very good at rugger. He thinks I'm a weakling. I'm not. I'm just not like him, that's all. He comes from a long line of bullies. In fact, it is required of the oldest son to be a bully."
"But you're the oldest son."
"Only son. Only heir. And I promise I will never be a bully, not even to my dog. Especially not to my dog." His eyes met mine and he smiled. "I like him," I thought. "He's kind. He's gentle." Then I reminded myself, this cannot go anywhere. A pleasant carriage ride on a fine afternoon, that's all. Instead of taking the road out to the Cape, we continued straight ahead, dipping down to a charming little bay edged with palm trees. Here he brought the carriage to a stop and motioned to a boy loitering nearby. "If you watch the horse, I'll give you a good tip," he said in French, that was not as bad as he had portrayed.
"Certainly, monsieur,"
the boy replied eagerly and went to stand at the horse's head. Giles helped me down, and we walked through a little park until we came out to the beach. There was another small harbour to one side, a stone jetty and a perfect curve of pale yellow sand around the bay. "You see?" he gestured to it as he took my arm down a flight of stone steps. "Not at all like Nice, which is absolutely horrible. Stones that cripple you and a steep drop-off once you're in the water. Here you can stand or float to your heart's content. Do you swim?"
"I'm afraid I've never had the opportunity," I said.
"Pity." We started to walk across the sand. It was a novel experience for me, feeling the softness under my feet.
"I gather the Queen loves to bathe whenever she gets the chance," Giles said. "I'm surprised she hasn't ordered her household to join her. It is a trifle early in the year, I'll grant you, but in a month or so you should give it a try. I'll teach you if you like."
"I don't even own a bathing costume," I said.
"I'm sure a local seamstress can run you up one between now and April. You'd love it. It is chilly in the spring, but bracing, and one feels so much better for being immersed in salt water."
"You've been here before, have you?" I asked.
"A couple of times. We stayed at Menton once in a rented villa, and once at Cannes, but this is definitely the nicest. My father is thinking of buying a villa here. Naturally, I'm encouraging him."
We walked along the edge of the water. Small wavelets rushed up toward our feet, then receded again, but the whole bay was remarkably calm.
"Is your mother with you?" I asked casually.
His face clouded.
"She died when I was only 6, he said. "She was expecting another baby, and it did not go well. She was such a sweet, gentle being. She liked to take me on her knee and read me stories. I still miss her. Isn't that strange?"
"Not at all strange. My mother died when I was a child, and I certainly miss her."
"Is your father still alive?"
"No, he died too. I have one married sister, but apart from that, I have no one."
"Ah, hence being put under the Queen's protection. Very wise.
Working in her kitchen was hardly the same as being put under her protection. I work for my living, you know, I felt obliged to say.
Of course you do. It's well known that the Queen is an absolute slave driver. You're not one of those maids of honour whom she keeps up until 1 in the morning, are you?
No, nothing like that. It'd be a disaster, I grinned. I get sleepy by 10.
The Queen is quite remarkable, isn't she? Drowles said.
Nearly 80 years old and still stays up past midnight, bosses around her Prime Minister and has her hand firmly on the reins of the Empire. He glanced up.
Speaking of reins, I don't suppose I should trust my horse to that boy for too long.
I gave a reluctant look back as we left the beach. Giles must have felt the same because he said,
Maybe next time we could arrange for a picnic.
If you would consent to a next time, that is. Again I hesitated, then I heard myself say,
Of course, I would love to have a picnic next time.
His face flushed with joy.
Jolly good. I'm so glad. Most girls I meet find me a bit of a bore, I'm afraid. I'm not dashing like the rest of the chaps.
Oh, I think dashing would be very hard to take in the long run, I said, and he laughed.
I say, there is a splendid little patisserie in Beaulieu. Would you care for a pastry and a cup of coffee before we return?
If you must go back, that is.
I really must. I was given permission for a free afternoon, that's all.
Even though the Queen is dining out?
I'm afraid so. They really are quite strict with unmarried girls in the household.
Of course, I understand.
But how about that pastry?
I wouldn't say no to that, I said. The sea air has given me an appetite.
He smiled again as if I had given him a present. We returned to the carriage and proceeded into the little town. Again Giles found someone to watch the carriage and we walked up a small high street to the pastry shop. The array of cakes and pastries was dazzling and so intricately made. I chose a chocolate-covered oblong with caramelized hazelnuts and chocolate curls on top. Giles went for a Baba O'Rum.
What is that? I asked him.
It's like a donut, but soaked in rum. Awfully good. Are you sure you don't want to try one?
Not rum in the middle of the afternoon, thank you, I said.
Oh, no, of course not. You couldn't return with your breath smelling of alcohol, could you?
Probably not the best idea.
We were laughing as we carried our pastries to a little table and the shop owner brought over cups of milky coffee. The pastry was beyond delicious. I'd like to have asked for the recipe, but that would have seemed rude. As I glanced at that glass counter with its myriad pastries, I realized how much I had to learn. I could make a passable dessert, but I still lacked skills in decoration and presentation. I resolved, while I was in France, to learn some of the finer points of pastries, and I paused to consider how passionately I felt about this. Did I really want to become a real chef, even if the prospect of marriage was offered to me? I glanced across at Giles, who was tucking into his Baba O'Rum. Viscountess Faversham. I tried out the idea in my head.
You must come down to the casino sometime, Giles said as we left the cafe and headed back to the Excelsior Regina.
Which is the casino?
You must have noticed it. That building on the pier, with the big glass dome. It's awfully jolly and ridiculously formal too. They won't let you in unless you are properly dressed. I understand they turned away Lord Salisbury because he wasn't dressed well enough. He chuckled. Can you imagine telling the Prime Minister to leave?
Don't suppose they knew he was the Prime Minister, I said. He doesn't look very stately, does he?
He doesn't. Have you seen him walking around Beaulieu with that shapeless old hat on his head? One could mistake him for a tramp. I wonder the Queen doesn't tell him to shape up. She's usually a stickler for people looking the part. I say, is it true about that Indian chap she has with her?
Is what true?
That he's more than a servant, would you say?
You're implying their relationship isn't quite proper, I asked.
She is 77, you know. I'm told she likes to have handsome young men around her.
But there has been talk.
I overheard at Lady Mary's party. They were saying he thinks of himself as one of the gentlemen of the court, when in fact he was sent over as a table servant.
You're quite right in that, I said. There is a lot of discontent.
The gentlemen of the household all threatened to resign if he came here with the Queen, but they backed down, I'm afraid, and he's here, trying to lord it over everybody. And the Queen allows this. She won't hear anything against him. He has become far too familiar with her all the time. And he's most disagreeable to everyone else, dictating that special food should be cooked for him and riding in his own carriage when the real gentlemen are all crammed in together. I wonder where it will lead, Giles said. Somebody will have to do something about him, surely. I think they are trying to, I said. One way or another, I thought, but didn't say. I say, I've had a most spiffing afternoon with you, Giles said as we came around the corniche and descended into Nice. I hope we can do it again very soon, or perhaps you can escape for an evening and we could go to dinner somewhere. There's a perfect little restaurant out on a rock surrounded by sea. I've been dying to try it. Alarm bells were going off in my head. This was madness. If it was discovered that Giles had been courting a servant, I'd probably be dismissed, and Giles would be in trouble with his father. I knew little of the ways of men. I was just the means of spending a pleasant afternoon. He might enjoy outings with any number of young ladies and have a potential wife lined up at home in England. I could not risk my future for something that would probably lead nowhere. I paused in mid-thought. Did I want it to lead somewhere? I glanced across at him. He had a nice enough face, and he was sweet and amusing, and I had to admit that the prospect of being Lady Faversham, of righting the wrongs to my father, was rather tempting. But I really was leaping ahead here. Giles deposited me outside the Regina. I thanked him for the lovely afternoon. He said he should be thanking me and looked forward to seeing me again when the Queen could spare me. Just drop me a note, he said. I'll be waiting anxiously. I'm not sure that I'll be able to meet you again, I said hesitantly. We are not supposed to have assignations with young men. He laughed. I wouldn't call coffee in Beaulieu an assignation, would you? We have been so frightfully proper, and I am a perfectly respectable chap, you know. You can look me up in Burke's Peerage. Good old family. Solid stock. Then the smile faded and a worried look came to his face. Unless you don't want to see me again and you found this afternoon horribly dull. I'm not the most scintillating of conversationalists, so I've been told. Oh no, I really did have a lovely time, I said. It's just rather complicated in my current situation. Then we shall correspond in secret. He gave me an impish grin. You shall drop me a note when you might be free, and if I respond, I shall send it to the hotel rather than to the Queen's party. And they never need to know. He jumped down from the trap and came around to take my hand, assisting me down. His hand lingered too long in mine, and I think he was considering whether to say more or even kiss me. I avoided this by giving him a bright smile. Thank you again. I must go before I'm seen and given a lecture. I went inside feeling horribly awkward. I had encouraged him, misled him, when the Queen could spare me indeed. The Queen didn't even know I was part of her retinue here in Nice, and nothing could come of this, even if I wanted it to. But I had to admit it was nice to be treated like a lady, to sit beside a young man in a carriage. This is what my father and mother would have taken for granted in their youth, I thought, and felt a tinge of that anger and resentment that had haunted me since I was sent into service. Chapter 24. There was great excitement at the Excelsior Regina. The famous French actress Sarah Bernhardt had come to stay. Not with the Queen, I hastened to add, but in the hotel proper. In fact, it was rumoured that the Queen disapproved of her because of her loose ways. Therefore, we were all surprised when it was announced that the Queen had requested Sarah to give a special performance just for her and her household at the hotel. What is more, we were all to be invited. The vast pillared dining room was turned into a theatre for the evening, the dais at one end surrounded by potted palms. We servants had to wait until the entire royal party was seated. Then we were ushered in and allowed to stand at the back.
the Grand Dame came onto the stage and performed several monologues, all in French, but she was so good that one didn't even have to understand the language. The whole audience watched transfixed. She finished to tumultuous applause. Someone rose from the crowd to escort her down from the stage. It was the Prince of Wales. Of course, I remembered that I had heard a rumour that she was once his mistress. He led her over to the Queen to be presented. I decided this was a good time to leave the room before the Prince could notice me. "You really do flatter yourself, Bella," I said to myself once I slipped through the door at the back of the dining room into the narrow hallway leading to the kitchens. "The Prince flirted with you once. Do you really think he'd notice you when the great Sarah Bernhardt was present?" And I had to laugh at my own vanity. I had almost reached the kitchen when I heard a male voice behind me calling my name, or at least the name by which I went these days. I stopped and turned around, thinking it was Jimmy with some witty comment about the actress. But it wasn't. It was Ronnie Barton. "Well, well," he said, smirking as he came towards me. "We meet again, Miss Helen Barton." He said the words with greater emphasis. "What are you doing here?" I demanded. "The same as you, I'd imagine, taking my chances when I get them." "You're here with the Prince of Wales?" I could hardly make myself say the words. "I am. I'm doing rather well for myself, actually, thanks to you," he said. "Shall we go and talk somewhere? Catch up on old times up in Yorkshire when we were lads and lasses?" "I don't think we have anything to say to each other," I said haughtily. "Oh, but we do. I'd love a good chat with someone from home," he said. "Bringing back old times up on the moor." My one thought was that I didn't want to risk bumping into anyone from the Queen's household or the French chefs. It would be all too easy for Ronnie to say the wrong thing and give me away. He'd enjoy that. "Come outside," I said. "The servants' entrance leads to the back of the hotel where nobody can disturb us." "Are you ashamed to be seen with your poor old brother?" he teased. "Mr. Barton," I said as soon as we stepped into the crisp night air. "Ronnie, I did what you asked of me. Apparently, you are well situated with the Prince, so you should want nothing more of me." "Maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't," he said. "My old long-suffering mother always did say I was greedy. She said I had ideas above my station and would come a cropper in the end. But it was Helen, the good child, who came a cropper, wasn't it? And I've landed on my feet." "Are you one of the Prince's footmen now?" I asked. He grinned. "Better than that. Much better. I'm his chauffeur." I couldn't have been more surprised.
"Chauffeur?"
"I told you I always take my chances when I can. Well, I heard that the Prince was going to buy one of these new automobiles, see? So I went to him and told him I wanted to be his driver and knew all about those combustion engines."
"How did you know that?"
"I didn't. But I figured by the time he got the automobile delivered from Germany that I could learn. So I found a bloke in London, and he taught me a thing or two about automobile motors. I've always been mechanically minded. I took to it like a duck to water. And the chauffeuring part, too. Once you get the confounded thing started, it's quite easy, knowing how to shift gears and all that. You can't ever go too fast because it spooks the horses when you encounter carriages. I haven't run anybody over yet." He started to smile, then seemed to remember what had happened to his sister and winced instead.
"I'm glad for you that you have found your profession and a good situation in life," I said politely. "Now, if you'll excuse me, I should get back to the rest of my party."
"Arcadur, the rest of my party. You give yourself airs now you work for the Queen, don't you?" I felt my hackles rising.
"I don't give myself airs, as you put it. I was brought up in a refined family. I've always spoken this way. Remember that I told you before that I was put into service as a child and have worked my way up by being good at what I do."
"Either that or someone in the household has taken a fancy to you." His eyes were challenging me now. "You're a fine-looking lass. Too bad you're my sister, or I might make a pass at you myself."
And speaking of making a pass, the prince is very upset with you.
With me?
The words came out as a squeak. When he told you he'd give me a job, you promised you'd come to see your dear old brother. And you haven't been once. I tried to keep the tone light.
Mr. Barton, I hardly think that the prince is interested in a lowly cook when he can have his pick of women.
Oh, but you're wrong. You turned him down. He loves a challenge. He said to me several times, "Where's your sister then? Why doesn't she come to visit you?" And I had to lie and say that you couldn't get time off. But that's all right. I can tell him now that you're right here and available.
Before I could stop myself, I reached out and grabbed his arm. "Please don't do that."
He really was smirking now. "You don't know a good thing when you see it. You become the prince's mistress for a while, you move in high society, then he tires of you and you're left with enough money for life and prospects for a good husband too. You'd be out of work and in kitchens for good." I gave him my haughtiest look.
"Mr. Barton, my body is not for sale. When I love a man, I'll let him touch me, and not before."
"Oh, hark at her. Pretty little miss, isn't she?"
"You won't tell him, will you? Please don't." I regretted it instantly. He was the sort who fed on fear. "Anyway, the great Sarah Bernhardt is here now. He'll only have eyes for her."
"She's yesterday's news. He said he likes them young and fresh, poor old prince. He don't have much to make him happy, does he? No job, nothing to do except amuse himself. His mother won't share any responsibilities with him, won't let him in on foreign affairs or government briefings. She thinks he's weak and he'll make a bad king, so she intends to go on living as long as she can."
"Well, wouldn't you?" I asked.
"To my notion, he'll make quite a good king," Ronnie said. "He's not stupid, you know, and he gets on well with people. And when he does, all the better for me, eh?"
He stepped closer to me, even though we were alone in the darkness.
"Between you and me, he thinks his old mum is losing her mind. Going a bit senile."
"Oh, I don't think," I began, but he went on.
"That Indian bloke, the Munshi, she's besotted with him, isn't she? And you know what we heard? She shows him her important papers. Confidential papers, things she won't even share with her own son. The prince has been talking to doctors about having her certified as insane now. Not fit to make decisions regarding the safety of our country."
"You seem to know a lot about what the prince says or thinks," I said. "I don't expect he discusses his doings with a lowly chauffeur."
He touched the side of his nose. "You'd be surprised how much you overhear when you are driving a motor car. You're invisible, see? They talk as if you were not there. And it's a good place for a really confidential chat where he can't be overheard. Oh, I've heard things that would make your hair curl, believe me. And I know he's just about had enough of the way his mum is behaving. He's ready to take some kind of action."
I knew the Prince of Wales wasn't the only one who was upset with the Munshi, but I wasn't about to share anything I had overheard with a person like Ronnie Barton.
"I should go in," I said. I turned away. This time, he was the one who reached out and grabbed my sleeve.
"You know, I've been thinking," he said.
"You could be quite helpful in your way."
"I've already helped you, Mr. Barton. I owe you nothing more."
"Not to me, to the prince, for the good of the country."
"In what way?" He leaned closer.
"You're a cook. You could maybe add a little something to Her Majesty's food."
"Are you saying I should poison the Queen? Are you out of your mind?" I said the words louder than I intended, I was so shocked.
"Not poison her as such," he said. "I'm thinking more along the lines of something that might upset her stomach, give her the trots, make her weak so that she might catch any disease that's going around. Even a simple gripe could finish her off. You'd be well rewarded, I promise you."
"I wouldn't dream of doing such a thing," I said. "And for your information, the Queen seems to have a cast-iron stomach. She eats and drinks enough to make you or me sick."
"There are certain patent medicines." He paused.
"Did your employer say these things? He'd really do something to kill his mother?"
"No, the idea just came to me while we were talking. But I know how fed up he is with his current situation.
I know what he thinks about her carrying on with the Indian, and if she happened to pop off, he wouldn't grieve too much, so I thought I might do him a little favour.
It was my turn to smile. You've just made a wrong move, Mr. Barton. I now have something to hold over you. If you ever say one word about me to the prince or to anyone, I'll be only too happy to spill the beans that you asked me to poison the queen. I believe that might be a hanging offence, don't you?
I never said...
He was now rattled.
I only suggested... Let's just stay well away from each other in the future, I said. If I see you anywhere near our kitchen, I will let the head cook know what you are planning.
You wouldn't, he glared at me. Because if you did, I'd tell them the truth about you and what you did to my poor sister. Then we'd both hang.
Is that what you are saying?
I think we both have every reason to stay silent, Mr. Barton. I'm going in now, and I don't expect to see you ever again. I turned and walked back into the hotel, leaving him standing there.
Chapter 25. I tried to put the encounter with Ronnie Barton out of my mind. I was off the hook now, I thought. If I told anybody what he had suggested to me, he'd be in serious trouble. I felt the load of worry I had been carrying was finally lifting from my shoulders. But I did worry for the Queen. If someone as lowly as Ronnie Barton had thoughts like that, maybe others might have the same ideas. Maybe even the Prince himself might not be averse to helping his mother to join her beloved Albert in the great beyond. I resolved to keep a strict eye on everything that went to her table. Actually, I suspected we were quite safe. Our kitchen was a private world. We rarely saw outsiders, and the only members of the royal party we encountered were the obnoxious Munshie, who came in regularly to complain that he could not eat any of the food served at table, and the equally obnoxious Count Willie, who seemed to think he could wander in and help himself whenever he felt hungry between meals, which was often. Mr. Angelo tried in vain to complain about him to Sir Arthur, but Count Willie was a law unto himself, and apparently his visits to the kitchen were not entirely about food. I've had enough of that bloke, Jimmy muttered to me when we were slicing vegetables together.
Which bloke? That German idiot. He caught me in the hallway again last night, he said. Pinned me against the wall, if you can believe. He told me I was a pretty boy and he was sure we could have a little fun together. I told him I wasn't that way inclined. He wouldn't believe me. He said most people enjoy a bit of both ways, if you get my meaning.
I didn't.